This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
I think we'll start. I'm James Warden, and it's my pleasure to be... What are we, day what of the festival? Day four, five? Day four of the Heritage... Day three of the Heritage Festival. I want to say a little bit about the University of Canberra and then introduce Adele, because this is a little bit of our graphic design from the university, and we've cooked up three things, so to speak, for the Heritage Festival this time around, and look forward to, I think, an increasingly greater involvement with the Heritage Unit and the festival in the years to come. And this year we decided to go for, rather than three of the same theme, to pick different themes, food, clearly, a longer-term project that we'll probably have on convicts, and particularly later this year and next year concentrating on this region, the convict sort of layer of this region. And Jeff Brownrigg, who many of you will know from the National Film and Sound Archive and now of the University of Canberra, will talk about film. But by way of further introduction, the Donald Horne Institute was something we concocted at the University of Canberra last year as a way of concentrating the cultural heritage program in terms of collections and the heritage estate and places on the one hand, and perhaps more significantly, to revive the Conservation of Cultural Materials degree, which came to a bad end about 5 years ago. And we've managed to re-establish that and had the first intake of 22 or 3 students this year. So we'll be turning out graduates in materials conservation in the next 3 years from now, because of the increasingly serious crisis in that profession. And our new Vice-Chancellor, Stephen Parker, well, 2 years new, saw the logic of that argument and supported the establishment of the Institute, named after Donald Horne, who was the second Chancellor of the University. And it's a way of organising our teaching, our research, our public partnerships, and, very importantly, events like this, to give, if you like, a brand or a label or a vehicle to participate in these sort of exercises. And it was Meredith Hinchliffe's idea to invite Adele and to come to talk about food and heritage. And it sort of dawned on me a little while later that Adele and I had known each other 20-something years ago at the University of New South Wales, where she was in history and I was in political science. And just resuming that conversation 20 years on tonight, we realised that Homer Hudson ice cream was a big sort of event in her house, which I was an occasional visitor. I don't know if Homer Hudson still is in the landscape, is it? Is it? Okay, it's different. So, Adele's come to talk about food and space, and I think space is a really splendid theme for the whole festival, because you can do a lot with it. But quickly, before I pass over the platform to Adele, I just want to say a couple of things about food, because aside from a coincidence at the University of New South Wales and knowing quite a lot of people in common, Adele and I are both members, she doesn't know this I think, but members of the Centre for Research in Food and Drink at the University of Adelaide. And I've got an abiding interest in food as heritage as well, from a slightly different perspective. And indeed it might be one of our research themes in the future, is to develop much more of an interest on food, so we might be able to make you a visitor to the University of Canberra as well. But by an amazing coincidence, tonight is the 2,500th year of the publication by a Sicilian Greek called Archistratus of a poem about food, which is now recognised really as the first... Archistratus is credited as being the first food writer. And he talked about things like the need for fresh flavours at the right time of year, that shouldn't be covered with other flavours. Like if you've got a fresh fish from the sea, you shouldn't dump cheese on it. You should enjoy it in its prime. Now this is a very contemporary cooking idea, culinary idea, that I'm sure we'd adopt now. We do. He also said, have nothing to do with the Syracusans because they drink like frogs and don't eat anything. It's also the 509th anniversary of the first English cookbook called The Noble Book of Cookery, Book of Cookery, published in 1500. And then 1521, a book that was really the tradition of cookery books into the 18th and 19th century, which is really a lifestyle book. And the reason I've got this slide up here is this is a 1988 publication of the Australian Heritage Cookbook with a terrible cover. That was another lifestyle book projected as a sort of gift that you could give to foreigners about Australia because it was about lifestyle or projecting the Australian lifestyle. Now that is it looks like it's just one of those sort of non-books that's a few recipes and photographs, but that's really a kind of long tradition in publishing cookbooks, which also depends on literacy. You've got to be able to read them. And a professor at UC published a book called The Country House, University of Cambridge, not University of Canberra, published a book in 1736 called The Country Housewife and the Ladies Directory. That was really the first English book directed specifically at women. And then following through to maybe where Adele's going to pick up the story, I'm not sure. 1783, there's a book published called The London Art of Cookery by John Farley. Now, I don't know if that book was on the First Fleet. They brought many volumes with them, and I hope they did, because it's got a kind of convict quality about it, because it's written of in the Encyclopedia of Cookery as the most extensive piece of plagiarism in the 18th century. There was one recipe in a large book that has not been traced back to immediate predecessors of that book, and that was a recipe for beef tea. So it's possible that book came to Australia early on. Now, Adele will pick up some of those themes, I think, but I just want to say a few words to introduce her. And she, I'm sure, will trespass onto the or wander onto the ground of cookbooks as well. That's a page that some of you may be familiar with out of that National Treasures book about cookery books in national collections. Because food is clearly one of Adele's abiding interests. She's a graduate of the University of New South Wales with both honours in history and a PhD, has taught at Southern Cross since 1996, and one of her most recent jobs is to help choose the new Vice-Chancellor of that institution, which is getting married up to Charles Sturt. She was a visiting fellow at the University of Adelaide in 2006 and 7, and a visiting fellow here at the museum in 2008. She's got one of those wonderful sort of array of research interests that I really like. She's written on lighthouses, the Pacific War from veterans' experiences, floods, the industrialisation of food and the art of eating. She's written on homesickness. And something splendid term, the tastescape of historical identities, which I'm sure will emerge tonight too. And a beautiful phrase which is connected to the slow food movement, which she's called slow learning. So it's with great pleasure that I introduce Adele to you to talk about perhaps slow cooking and slow learning.
That was actually the song that you were listening to, and I'll explain the reason for that in a minute. I wanted to start by respectfully acknowledging the past and traditional owners of this land, the Ngunnawal people. And it's a great privilege to be here, thanks to the Donald Horne Institute and to the museum for inviting me. I chose the waitress song because it reminded me that food is about a lot more than what actually ends up on our plates. It's also about relationships. And I'm sure a lot of us eat things for a whole lot of different reasons, most of it cultural, some of it personal, and not always to do with the purity of taste or the availability of ingredients. And so I wanted to set the scene really by playing that song to start with. when we cook and we invite people over for dinner and so on, we often do a lot of things to set the scene. In fact, cooking is such a cultural thing, and eating with people is, that we make up all sorts of rules about eating, you know, that you can't laugh at the table, that you can't talk at the table. We play music sometimes, we set the table in particular ways, we order ourselves around it and so on. And so I think it's quite important to consider all of the things, really, that go into the makeup of a meal. I'm going to concentrate on dinner tonight, partly because we're so close to it, and I really admire all of you for for coming, and also because I think we've given up breakfast in lots of ways to the corporations. We've given it over to cereal manufacturers, and it doesn't sort of figure a great deal. And lunch too. How many people here had lunch today? At your desk? Yeah. So I think that's a really interesting thing. In fact, it's such a crisis that Nutrition Australia have launched this thing called Lunch Week to try and popularise the idea of lunch. 1 in 10 people say that they never eat lunch, and most people regularly skip lunch at some stage. It's also that lunch, dinner, supper, tea are all variously confused in a lot of the Australian literature as well. And so that suggests some of the difficulties that we have sometimes in talking historically about food. You wouldn't necessarily know that, though, from looking at the volume of discussion on food. There are recipes and recipes and recipes everywhere. There are re-released versions of cookbooks like the Common Sense Cookery Book and Margaret Fulton. There are ABC websites that are dedicated to food, podcasts that Jamie Oliver is doing and so on. And all of that gives the impression that food is, in fact, something that's very easy to talk about. But as Farb and Amalagas remind us, food is often used to express things that are sometimes very difficult to articulate in ordinary language. And so inviting people over for dinner can be easier than saying, I want to be your friend. So food is used in a whole range of ways, really, to establish relationships between people. And what we eat also tells us a great deal about our history and a great deal about our personal life. Donald Horne was aware of that, and I've got a very long quote there from Horne that you don't have to read all of. But Horne was interested in cultural sustainability as the fourth pillar of sustainability, and he considered that how and what we eat was one of those things that's very important to cultural sustainability. I think it'd be something interesting to consider in terms of thinking about our own culinary heritage, what aspects of the food that we eat we would consider to be related to something that we'd promote as cultural sustainability, and what we might actually give up. The theme of the seminar today is food, migration and identities, and the use of food as a home building practice. And I'm going to look at that through two interrelated lenses. The first is the idea of home and the use of food as a way of making people feel at home. And I'm going to get you to do a bit of an exercise on your childhood food memory, so that's what that sheet is there for. And the second is how food was transformed through migration, how it acquired different meanings and so on through the processes of migration. I'm going to use examples from the colonial period to look at the relationship between food and home, and then I'm going to use some more contemporary kind of cookbook magazines and so on to talk about that transformation. In Australia, I think those two aspects of our culinary heritage are mutually dependent. It's actually quite difficult to talk about Australian food and home without thinking about the local and thinking about the global as well. So tonight I want to bridge a bit of the gap between the space of our own home kitchens and the wider kind of national space and the broader world in which we've acquired a lot of our food. I think the theme of time and space is really quite apt to be talking about food. Joseph Banks described the homesickness of sailors on the Endeavour by saying that they suffered from a roast beef mentality. That food metaphor was well chosen, and the condition was enduring. If we are what we eat, a lot of people would say that Australians, until recently, were thoroughly British. Roast beef itself was part of a construction of British national identity, and its popularity coincided with the colonisation of Australia. The roots of Australian cooking and food production then begin in the England of the 1700s. Robert May had a recipe for roast beef and his accomplished cook that was published in 1660, but he's already speaking with nostalgia of the lost days of noblemen's feasts. He says, before good housekeeping had left England. Hannah Glass, on the other hand, directed the art of cookery made plain and easy to servants rather than the mistress, and the book was intended as a manual for what she called the lower sort. At this stage, there was an increasing number of cookbooks that were published aimed at the increasing middle class, so to free up women from having to instruct their servants in how to cook meals. The Art of Cookery was published in 1747, and it was popular for at least 100 years. It was really popular in Australia. That's indicated by the relationship that some historians have seen, Barbara Sandwich and Colin Bannerman, for instance, between jugged hare, which was a glass recipe, and the kangaroo steamer, which has been described as the finest dish of Australian colonial cookery. Kangaroo was the leading indigenous food source in colonial Australia, and it was eaten in various ways. The kangaroo steamer has been called the most characteristic and enduring dish of this period. James Boyce's explanation of its heritage related to the convict ration, where people would often get fresh kangaroo meat and some salt pork, and so they put it together in a pot and made what was called a kangaroo steamer. A new settler to Van Diemen's Land described the first meal of the assigned convicts on his land in the following way. The hind quarters of kangaroo cut into mincemeat, stewed in its own gravy with a few rashers of salt pork. This dish is commonly called a steamer. They add to that a sufficient quantity of potatoes and a large cake, which we could assume was a damper, cooked on the spot. Native produce was by necessity an important part of colonial diets, but few differences in food preparation show up in a lot of early cookbooks. The Rosens, Paul and Elizabeth Rosen, have referred to this thing called the flavour principle, and what they suggest is that the way that new foods get incorporated is by using flavours that are considered to be familiar to particular people. So in Australia, you get a lot of recipes for things like kangaroo tail soup, which is like oxtail soup, and kangaroo tail curry and so on, which we're using familiar sorts of flavours in a way of kind of incorporating those sorts of things. The first cookbooks incorporated new foods in English styles of cookery. In the first cookbook that was published in Australia by Edward Abbott, who was born in Australia actually, evoked the roast beef of old England. Oh, the use of such a potent symbol of English identity in the 19th century may seem likely, and colonists often relied on English cookbooks. New ingredients were adapted to fit in with familiar culinary expectations. Abbott drew on native and exotic ingredients to produce very familiar dishes using English methods and principles, such as kangaroo stuffed with beef suet, breadcrumbs, parsley, shallots, marjoram, thyme, nutmeg, pepper, salt, cayenne and egg. In the 1890s, a larger body of locally written books became available, but by this time the food supply was held to be abundant and secure, and the cultivation of exotic foods in Australia like wheat, sheep and cattle had established a long-term and familiar food supply. At the same time, though, Australian foods were also being incorporated into English cookbooks. So in 1890s, for instance, you get Isabel Beaton using kangaroo in her recipe books as well. Mrs. Beaton's cookery book and household guide gave a selection of Australian recipes to the English: kangaroo tail soup, roast wallaby, parrot pie, which was not unlike one made of pigeons, bandicoots and tomatoes, and so on. A recipe for kangaroo tail curry brings together the British invention of curry powder from India with Australian ingredients. Far from being bound by geography and material resources, culinary cultures then inhabit multiple times and places that mutually constitute each other. The culinary products of the mother country had quite a different meaning in Australia. Despite being expensive, for instance, people in Sydney were often served salted cod and preserved fish rather than the local native fish, which was abundant and would have actually tasted much better. Colonial tastescapes then were constructed in England and Australia, and through the consumption of food, they were both socially and personally subjective. Similarly, the taste for curry in India was in striking contrast to the attitudes of the British in India. So while in India people were relying on eating English-style foods, in India itself they were differentiating themselves by eating English foods. But in England at the same time, curry was becoming more and more popular. And being branded and named things like Madras curry, although it may not have actually come from there, and then being sold to Australia. So you get an interesting kind of triangular trade going on, and a lot of what was happening in Australia was coming from elsewhere. In that sense, it's more than taste and tradition which is impacting on how people are actually cooking. If people just brought their taste preferences with them, you wouldn't necessarily get any change in what people were cooking. So they were also using food in some ways to differentiate themselves, and they were using food to make themselves feel at home at a time when they didn't really have any of those other kind of tangible or material relationships that could make things feel familiar. The contemporary incarnation of curry as an ethnic food only makes sense in terms of the way that it gets differentiated culturally. Curry is considered ethnic, for example, and a cup of tea is considered English, although tea was never actually grown in England. In a cookbook that was published in the 1950s that brought together a lot of recipes from the Commonwealth, Robin Howe complained that the average Australian will do their best to insist that all the cooking that they do is laid down in a pattern that's familiar to them through their British forebears. True Australian food, he advised, will only be found in homes and outside the cities. Murray River cod, colonial goose, kangaroo tail soup and barramundi. Upward mobility required acquiring a taste for imported foods and distancing oneself from local produce and cooking. People in the country, though, may have been dependent on those sorts of native foods also by necessity. The question of how to market a country that doesn't have a clear culinary heritage has faced lots of people, and that includes food historians. Food traditions, though, are born from exchange. Food is one of the really early places where globalisation is manifested. In ancient Rome, people were eating oysters from Colchester and so on. So there were already a lot of exchanges and things that were going on before Australia itself was actually colonised. Food played a role, though, in enculturating people as well and passing on certain types of memories and histories. The discourse of home can be called upon to create and sustain empire and was quite important in that sense, but it's actually much more ambiguous when you restore the experience of what people were having in England and think about what was going in other colonies as well. Another example of that kind of exchange are things like turtle soup, where Australia had cannery factories in some coastal regions and were set up to can turtle soup and send it back to England. But that actually came to Australia in some ways, that desire for it, through the British experience in the Caribbean. And turtle soup was so popular in Victorian England that even mock turtle soup was considered to be preferable to not having turtle soup at all, which is hard to imagine now. The incorporation of British foods was central to the colonial identity project in Australia, but the fact that British culinary culture was locally produced challenges the idea of an authentic British cuisine, which the colonies tried to replicate. National cuisine is a construction that can hide the histories of colonialism and its legacies. By the time that Abbott was advocating rabbit curry, for instance, in England, it wasn't authentic Indian food that was being used, but the British invention of curry powder incorporated into English culture. Food then is entwined in lots of ways with all sorts of cultural boundaries. We know that food plays an important process in home building, particularly in the situation... I missed that, sorry. Particularly in a situation of migration. Like more recent migrants, The British who came to Australia preferred familiar food and, despite pressures to the contrary, would continue to try and reproduce the foods that they knew. They took their food preferences with them, and they also took their food. Not knowing how to live off their land, parties of explorers and overlanders travelled with pack horses and bullocks, pulling heavy wagons full of supplies. The first changes to the land were made by stray cattle, escaping from travelling herds or pastoral holdings. Many of the foods that became established were bought on the first fleet. Wheat, barley, maize, various seeds and plants, things like grapes, oranges, cattle, sheep, sugar, peas, beans, turnips and potatoes. The English had left behind a very different climate with changing seasons, and it was a land of forests that supported permanent agriculture. It was relatively cool and damp. Few of them were farmers. At the time that Australia was being colonised, the things that characterised English culture at that time were rural exodus, coupled with incredible growth. Between 1800 and 1900, for instance, the European population doubled, and the search for fertile lands in order to feed Europeans was really significant to Australian colonialism. In Australia, important developments in the food industry, in preservation and in canning, for instance, and refrigeration, decreased transit times that came through transport changes, shaped the landscape, and it changed eating habits as well. Australia was a pioneer in food processing because food exports were always so important. And at the same time, the colonies were dependent on European imports in order to make themselves feel at home and to differentiate themselves from what was going on locally. The food consumed by colonists in Australia wasn't simply the residue of old food habits or traces of colonial history, but a device to reaffirm cultural and historical bonds and a shared sense of identity. Donna Gabaccia describes the link between food and identity in The Function of Nostalgia. It's easiest to see, she says, how food choices reflect the eater's identity. Humans cling tenaciously to familiar foods because they become associated with nearly every dimension of social and cultural life. Food thus entwines intimately with that which makes a culture unique, binding taste and satiety to group loyalties. Eating habits both symbolise and mark the boundaries of culture, she suggests. Food preferences then aren't incidental to identity. They aren't something that merely reflects it. They also help to constitute colonial identities and play a very significant role in everyday life and a central part of economic, social, political and cultural matters. Eating is the primary way, for instance, that we establish and maintain relationships. The relationship between food and home is an essential one. And when most people are asked to describe what a meal is or an important meal for them, it's generally one that invokes sharing it with family. So in some ways then food also contributes to the construction of what family is as well as the idea of home. The concept of home conjures up lots of meanings. And in Australia it refers not just to that place where people share relationships, but also the specific dwelling, which is quite different to the English etymology of the word. Colonisers, of course, didn't go home, and they problematised in some ways and fractured the sorts of food memories and ideas, the relationship between home and colony. So in Australia, you get things like Sunday roasts, people talk about hot English dinners and so on, that suggest perhaps that people have used that to suggest that people wanted to be elsewhere, that they had a sense of nostalgia and they longed to be somewhere else. But in some ways you could also use it to explain the way that they were also trying to make themselves feel at home. The thing about food is that it's an embodied... it gives you an embodied sense of the past. So sometimes in eating, food memories are also evoked. It's a way of bringing the past into the present. It resonates with something. Everybody's heard of Proust's beautiful description of Madeleine's, for instance, that brought him back immediately to his home life in French villages. In this way, food crosses boundaries between past and present and between producers and consumers and establishes different sort of relationships of meaning. And so I wanted you to think about your own food memories. Because food's such an important medium for personal memories and for collective memories, I want you to think about some food memories that evoke important memories for you. It could be a particular type of dish. It might be something that you use as a comfort dish like mashed potato, or it could be a food event, a birthday party or a Christmas dinner that you shared with friends and so on. I've got some sheets there where I've asked you some questions about your childhood food memory. So I thought it might be time actually to start a bit of a dinner conversation about some of those things. If I give you, say, five minutes to have a think about that, then I hope that we might be able to share some of those ideas. Okay, I can see lots of people still writing, but I thought it might be time actually to hand the microphone over. because I don't have a sheet. Could I borrow yours, Alison? Okay. You don't have to actually share and bear all of these things, but if food is a medium for personal and collective identities, and if people brought with them those sorts of food preferences, it would be good to think about, on a personal level, what that might actually mean. So I wanted to start with the food memory and associations that you have with it. Would somebody like to share theirs?
In our house, we used to have spaghetti with a can of Kraft braised steak and onions. This is something that I'm not necessarily proud of now. And I only have it now when Nick's away because he doesn't like it. But it has such a strong association with what I now look back on and see as a happy childhood. And they changed the recipe for Kraft braised steak and onions several years ago. When I found out that they were doing this, I went around Canberra and I bought as many cans as I could find, which I am still eating so far without ill effect.
See, I think that that's actually really interesting because it actually doesn't matter about the quality of it at all.
Well, I thought I may as well carry on because spaghetti's the theme. Until I was seven, I lived in England and I came out on the ship. And whilst on the ship, for the first time in my life, I ate something exotic, which was, in fact, spaghetti. Now, it may have been Kraft braised steak, for all I know, but to me, at that stage, at 7 years old, it was very exotic. And it was, I think, because now I'm an extremely eclectic eater and desperate for the new best thing and the new flavour, and I reckon that spaghetti that day, being such a major change from overcooked vegetables and dried out meat, was the thing that actually changed my life food-wise.
Tara, my wife and I went to Japan last year and went to a very small restaurant, said about 8 people, maybe 10, that was the favourite restaurant of a very good friend of my wife's. And it was an extraordinary meal of all those most impossibly crafted little morsels that just came in wave after wave. But my reason for noting this amongst too many other thoughts was that within that meal, which was truly extraordinarily good, was the most disgusting thing I've ever eaten, which was the, I think it was probably the entrails of sea anemone.
Sea urchin.
Sea urchin, thank you. Has anyone else eaten that?
Yeah.
It really is. They warned me and I thought, well, being an eclectic eater, I might as well have a go, and it was just powerfully appalling. Yeah.
Has developed, and it's not so strange food equals not so strange people. And the idea is that some foods are actually considered to be edible or inedible, depending on what your cultural associations with them are. So in Australia, you know, insects are a fantastic source of protein and widely abundant, but we tend to ignore them and have done with other sorts of foods as well, because they're just not those sort of cultural associations. It's what Michael Pollan calls the omnivore's dilemma, the fact that we could eat anything and can, but in fact only select certain things to eat, sometimes because of our taste. But sometimes it's the associations, because you knew what it was, did you? Okay. Any other food memories? Snake. See, snakes were widely shunned in Australia, but are beautiful.
A snack. No, I saw that you suggested that we might talk about breakfast cereals or snacks. And I too grew up in England, and I can remember a lot of you will be familiar with the European beech tree, and every few years beech trees produce viable seeds. They're called beech nuts. They're tiny little things, and children eat them. They produce them in their millions on a good year, and only children would eat them. And so I can remember walking home from school and going under a beech tree and getting these tiny little nuts and peeling the skin off and eating them. And they taste like nothing else. It's just a unique taste. And I don't suppose I'll ever taste it again, because when I go to England, it won't be the right time and it won't be the right season for the nuts.
And you won't be a child.
And I won't be a child, yes. So it's a sort of memory, yes.
And that takes us really to the next part of the talk, which is about food transformations, because some of those food memories are quite impossible to relive, or if you taste a food, it can transport you to a place, but the associations are very different to the places where you're eating them now. So I wanted to go on then to talk about the way that even though colonists kind of longed for food from their own memories of what it was like, in fact, those foods were already shaped by migration and exchange. And the quote that I wanted to use to illustrate that is from Stuart Hall, who himself was a migrant from the Caribbean to England, talking about the meanings of a cup of tea. I'll go back over to this one now. Thank you, Ken. People like me, he said, who came to England in the 1950s have been there for centuries. Symbolically, we've been there for centuries. I was coming home. I am the sugar at the bottom of a cup of tea. I am the sweet tooth, the sugar plantations that rotted generations of English children's teeth. There are thousands of others beside me that are, the cup of tea itself, because they don't grow it in Lancashire. Not a single tea plantation exists within the United Kingdom. This is the symbolisation of English identity. I mean, what does anybody in the world know about an English person except that they can't get through the day without a cup of tea? And in the 19th century, that was also true for Australia. Australia had an insatiable appetite for tea, and it was something that commentators frequently observed about the amount of tea that was drunk. It had been a delicacy in the 1700s, but prices had dropped considerably in the 19th century. And as commodity production increased, so too did the importance of those colonies where the tea was produced. In that sense, products kind of change their significance and meaning along the path that takes us from where things are produced to the table. In Australia, a cup of tea signified something about the mother country. The environment and the social costs of that kind of production and transportation can get obscured in the process as well. So not really knowing where the foods came from was something that, in a sense, was already happening in the 19th century. In his classic work on sugar, Sidney Mintz suggests that there's an inside and an outside to looking at food history. The inside view suggests what a product actually means to the person who's consuming it and preparing it, and how they view it. And it's possible to look at things like cookbooks and meals to consider that. What are people eating? How popular are those things and so on? Even though people may not actually use them to cook, we can suggest something about the symbolism of the food through that. The outside meaning, he said, involves a much greater distance. It's looking at the kind of social and political production of food as well. So after making a few points about sort of cooking in general, I wanted to think about that in terms of your own experience of what you ate last night for dinner from an inside and an outside perspective. The gastronomic landscape of Australia is a transnational one. It's created by tastes that not internal necessarily to Australia, but linked elsewhere through different cultures, histories, ideas and so on, which Doreen Massey argues constructs places. Like other traditions, food doesn't have to be place-bound. The identity of region to which its food contributes is not only dictated by the availability of ingredients, how these are used and consumed is mediated by culture and economy as much as geography, and these have a reciprocal impact on each other. We are simultaneously local and global. Carpet bag steak, which is a good way of illustrating this, doesn't use any distinctive ingredients. This is Bert Newton's favourite dish from a 1960s magazine. Even the combination of steak and oysters had already happened in England in things like oysters and beefsteak pie and grilled steak that was served with oyster sauce. The carpet bag steak, though, has been described as an Australian recipe. Sanchich describes it as one of Australia's contributions to the world's gastronomic treasure house. Has anyone had one? See, it's just virtually disappeared. Did you enjoy it, Julie? Yeah, absolutely. I would not have tried it except for this talk. And it is extraordinarily good. A lot of people talk about it because in 19th century recipes you see it quite often, and it does reappear in things like these sorts of collections, from this one from the 1960s. It was celebrity stars' favourite foods. It also appears in Robin Howe's book on the Commonwealth, cookery book, but it kind of disappears from a lot of the classic Australian cookbooks at the time. Carpet bag steak suggests the coming together of a whole lot of different sorts of food traditions, the engagement across different boundaries that makes food visible. Farb and Amalagas compare a cuisine to a culture's language, a system of communication that's reproduced at birth and hard to shake as an adult. Even after migration, people sustain the accent of their native cuisine. Some national cuisines speak louder to others than others, and it's a bit like language, you know, people saying, I don't have an accent, everybody else has one, and I don't have a cuisine, nobody, you know, it's everybody else has one. And so carpet bag steak could be seen in that way as well. With Farb and Amalagas is Elizabeth Rosen and Warren Belasco both all argue that a cuisine has four different types of elements, and so I want to use this to discuss Australian culinary heritage. First, each cuisine has a limited set of basic foods or primary edibles. So what do you think that they would be for Australia? Wheat would be a huge one, yep. And all the bread and the pasta and everything that comes from that. Really important. Australia is one of the world's biggest beef exporters. Yeah, and that's interesting when you think about the roast beef and the importance of that. Meat generally figures quite highly. So you get things like this Australian Women's Week cookery book, which under the general heading for main courses was just called meats because that's what people assumed were, in a sense, were main courses. The second thing is that cuisines are usually distinguished by their flavour principles, a sort of a way of combining foods. So in China, for instance, you have soy and ginger and garlic. The French cream and herbs. In Mexico, it's chili and coriander and lime. And they're the things, really, so that even though there might be different sorts of ingredients, those kind of flavour principles underpin the food in some ways. So can you think of what flavour principles would underpin Australian food? So that's kind of salt. It's heavy salt, and in a sense, you could argue that, you know, generations of salted beef have had an impact there. People were eating, you know, beef that was years old, drenched in salt.
What period are you
talking about? In the colonial period, sorry, and things that might have actually had an impact now. From the way that they were. Yeah, and some people have argued that, you know, that transformation, in a sense, has intensified, but that, you know, you had a much earlier period of kind of food combining that was happening as well. The colonial period's often been described as being fairly bland, but I wonder if that's also because of people's experience with food, because salt, in a sense, is not really bland at all, but a real flavour enhancer and would be one of those things. The other thing is the manner of preparing food. So whether it's mincing, cooking, frying, roasting, that kind of thing is also considered to be one of the elements of cuisine. And in some places that's dictated by what the energy that might be available. So in Southeast Asia you have things that are cooked very fast that don't use a lot of energy. Can you think of foods in Australia, sort of ways of preparing foods in Australia that are fairly common? Yeah. And part of that kind of relates to that British heritage too, doesn't it? Yeah.
But it sort of took advantage of both slow cooking in terms of soups, and not just casseroles and stews. But everyone, I grew up for a while with a wood stove, there was always something cooking on the stove.
Yeah. And to some extent, too, it's about the availability, I guess, of cooking utensils and things. So camp ovens would have been really important. Robin Howe lists lots of recipes that you could only cook in a camp oven, which by 1958 nobody had. But it's those sorts of long-cooked stews and things that become important. The other sort of element of cuisine is the way that something is eaten, which prescribes who eats it and how they eat it and what the manners and the rules and so on of the table might be. To some extent, this is necessary because otherwise the people who had the most money and the people who were the most powerful would eat everything and nobody else would get anything. So, you know, it's a sort of a way, really, of distributing food. But it also changes, in a sense, over time as well. If I said to my children that they weren't allowed to talk at the table, I would never get anyone there. It's the way, in a sense, that I probably learnt to speak was at a table, sharing food with other people. So I think it's actually, you know, those sorts of things can vary on a personal level. But are there things you think that Australians have in common that is about the way that the food is eaten and consumed? Sorry?
Outdoor food.
Yeah. Even though it wasn't really an Australian invention, it's something that's quite important. Yeah.
I occasionally, like once a month or so, pick up the fork with my right hand and then it's quickly followed by me slapping my own hand and putting it back in my left hand.
Well, some of that might be to do with when the US was colonised as well. So, you know, forks actually weren't really that common. And so, you know, you could use a knife for both. And I think that is a really interesting kind of carryover. It seems incredibly awkward, but perhaps it helps them to digest their food better than us.
Well, the able to be okay with one hand.
Yeah.
Actual cultural difference in the way that German people use their knife in the right hand. they'll hold the fork with a scoop motion, whereas the British pack it on the back of the fork. And the Yanks, when I did that, when I was over there, just looked at me like I was alien, going, why are you making it more difficult for yourself?
So to those sorts of basic elements then, the other thing to add would be the processes of getting food from the farm to the table, you know, and there are a lot of different things that are involved in that. So if you think about your own meal and you think about, you know, the roast that you had yesterday, for instance, where did it come from? What was involved? And it's a whole range of people that really complicate that food process and the food chain for us, in a sense. There are researchers, marketers, retailers, you know, even once you get away from the food producers and the packages and then the people who prepare it for us, which could be us, or the people who half prepare for us if you buy bags of pre-prepared potatoes and so on. So it's actually, in a sense, quite complicated. If we were to apply then those sorts of main principles to the food that we, to the foods that we had, or to look at some of the cookbooks, you could argue that meat has been significant from the Australian Women's Weekly. Cans have been very important to Australian history. This is from a canned goods on display at New South Wales Exposition of 1892 in Chicago. Other sorts of food, processed foods have been important because of the distances that people had to travel. So not just, you know, dead potatoes, things like suet mixes, seasoning mixes, instant coffee, that kind of thing. And then there's this question about flavours. There's been a popularity of, you know, Italian and Chinese foods and so on, you know, since the after World War II. But some people have argued that while that has rested on this idea of authenticity, the more they could appeal to a wider audience by being more like the sorts of things that Australians wanted to eat, the more popular those were likely to become. And this is a really early recipe for pizza, which was called mock pizza, but it was made from a basic scone recipe. And that's how I learnt to make pizza too, using a scone recipe rather than yeast in my domestic science classes at school, because it was something that I would have been already familiar with, in a sense. So it wasn't really so much like Italian pizza. It was really much more like a savoury scone, in a sense. The notion of taste and sense of what makes a proper meal and naturalised at all sorts of conscious and unconscious levels. But it's easier to see, in a sense, how these are manifested if we think about our own foods. So the second exercise that I wanted you to do was think about what you had for dinner last night, and don't make up, you know, mashed potato with olive oil drizzled with truffle flakes, whatever. Think about what you did actually have last night and see if you can apply some of those basic kind of principles to it. What were the basic ingredients? Who prepared it? How was it prepared? What were the flavours? And, you know, as much as you know of where it came from. And we'll do that just for a little bit and for another 5 minutes before we finish up. There are a lot of labels in Australian cooking for imperial meats and colonial teas and all of that kind of stuff as well. And I think that's also really interesting. Some of those things were actually produced here, but they still had, they sort of resonated with a longer kind of culinary history. Imperial meats also made fresh meat too, not just canned meat. What did you have for dinner last night?
I had a curry, which was made by my housemate. I share a house with a guy. We're both students, and we share cooking and purchasing of food fairly equally. And it was a jar of curry, which we made with cubed beef, and we went beyond what the instructions on the jar was to add cubes of pumpkin and sweet potato to stretch the batch to make the meat go further, because this will feed us for the entire week of lunches and dinners. And that's the Yeah, it was an Indian curry. It was I think it was a Madras or a Rogan Josh, something. It was one of those two. Because I didn't make it, I can't really say. But yeah, that's kind of our budgetary meal arrangements. So we've had other things which have been a Mexican slushy, which is basically which we just made up by what do we have in our fridge, and it started off with minced beef, and then we added some two lots of capsicums to it, and then we tried to stretch the batch with as many different types of beans that we could find. So we go to the supermarket, and it was basically let's try and increase our veggie content, and because meat is expensive, we'll try and make it stretch for as long as we can. We can't afford to buy lunch at uni or CIT, so that's what we do. Yeah, we are pretty vanilla with all of that. It's kind of, we go with a Mexican theme. It's, you know, the most we deviate is adding things like carrot and sweet potato and things to it. So, yeah, or with curry with the pumpkin and the sweet potato. So, there you go, student budget cooking.
That's good. Making do has driven a lot of culinary heritage.
Making it last.
No, it'll be on tape though, recorded for posterity. But you didn't use your name. What did anybody else have for dinner? Did anybody analyse it according to those four elements? Any flavours? Maybe you didn't eat anything, or did people just not want to share what they ate?
And I don't know whether it being a Sunday night might make it a bit different, but we're sort of more recent empty nesters, so I'm trying to get used to not doing a big, big shop, especially having a younger son who's a tradesman who eats and eats and eats. So it's that. So yesterday it was very quick because I'd just done, as part of the Heritage Festival, folks, a 15K walk in Namaji National Park. So it was coming home really tired, so it was a really quick, convenient thing. So it was actually a prepackaged thing from Aldi, the pasta and then the sauce, but you actually mix the sauce with other ingredients, and a tossed salad. So I suppose it was this Italian. It was just eating in front of the television. The Einstein factor was on, and with the husband. So yeah, so it's just at that stage where I'm at.
Anybody else? I think there's a really big difference between what we assume people are eating at home too and what people are actually eating. There's a story about a magazine, an English magazine, at the in the 1930s that published a recipe that apparently was quite toxic, and they rang up hospitals and they rang the police to warn them that people could be coming really ill, and they tried to broadcast messages saying don't cook the food, and nobody presented, which suggests that in fact people don't necessarily eat, you know, or prepare the food that are in cookbooks. And I think you get something very different when you look at the kind of groceries that people are purchasing, and that was why I was interested in microwaves as well, because maybe they give us a better sign than looking at cookbooks for what people are actually eating at any particular moment. In the 19th century, people didn't have very many cookbooks, and so you could assume that they were often using the ones that they did have. They got them for very practical reasons, and they didn't have pictures or other things that would make them attractive in the ways that we use cookbooks now, which could be to give us inspiration for cooking, or could be just as a form of what Barry Smart calls gastronomic porn, that we're just kind of poring over them. Yeah, I mean, the cookbook industry now has to differentiate itself so much. So you get more and more kind of specialised cookbooks as well. It's like, you know, recipes for Sunday, recipes gluten-free, you know, cookbooks just for kids who are under five. So they're quite differentiated compared to the sort of cookbooks, more generic cookbooks that we've had historically.
I was going to
I was going to make a comment about the fact that in our house we've more or less stopped buying cookbooks because we just pick up recipes from magazines and newspapers and, in fact, the internet. If I've decided I want to do a banana cake, which is, in fact, one of the things we had last night, I'll go and just search for it on the internet and have a look at the different sorts of ways in which a banana cake might be made. You know, you get the English ones, you get the American ones, and normally I end up with an Australian one. So we were very exotic last night. We had coq au vin for dinner because my partner decided, and he cooked it, that we should celebrate the beginning of winter with a casserole kind of a dish. So it was one that I think it was a recipe he had found somewhere in a magazine and cut out, and he's got his own recipe book that he refers to every now and then. And then we had banana cake with custard that he made. So it was a much more fulsome evening meal than we would normally have on a Sunday. So
I think it's obviously, it's interesting the way that people acquire different sorts of information about cooking and how to cook as well, and how we also just continue to reproduce foods too from either our own childhood or heritage, or change them according to our own taste preferences. In a sense, that's what's also happening culturally in Australia as well, to do with Australian cooking. So lots of people will say, you know, is there such a thing as Australian cuisine? Are there any unique, distinctive flavours associated with it? Are there particular ways of cooking that differentiate it from other places? And the same thing's often said about other places as well, like the US, where there's a similar kind of settler colonialism and people have brought different sorts of traditions together. And one of those things is that people talk about fusion foods, but I think if you look at the kind of history of food and how early it was globalised and all of those sorts of different trade relations and the way that they became incorporated and in a sense appropriated by different sorts of countries, then in some ways the recent period has kind of intensified that sort of food exchange rather than inventing something that's completely new. 80% of Australians own a wok now, and that suggests that a lot of people are using them as well. But we probably are eating less kangaroo. If you wanted to find a good recipe for kangaroo, you'd be better off turning to some of the 19th century cookbooks than some of the more recent ones we have. And if you wanted to try something really distinctive like carpet bag steak, which is a great meal, some of those things are also found much earlier on. So there were food adventurers and changers, but in a sense people were using food to make themselves in some ways to feel at home. And it took some time before the differentiation that was necessary in that colonial period to ease, where people could feel comfortable about trying other sorts of foods as well. Thanks for coming and sharing your cooking experiences. I hope you go and have something very tasty for dinner.
Just a few words to wrap up and to thank Adele. Frank Morehouse has written a wonderful book called Martini, a Memoir, and it's partly a story about himself, but he's obsessively interested in the ingredients of martini and debates the martini from every possible imaginable angle, down to the shape of the toothpicks that you might use. So he goes through ingredients, preparation, flavours, the whole process of consumption. And he quotes someone where he says, the wonderful thing about the third martini is it opens the prospect of a fourth. and the whole thing of bartender to mouth that he just talks through in this wonderful detail. But he told a wonderful Donald Horn story about... Donald was a great luncher, famous Sydney luncher. Donald would lunch, and he rang Donald one day and said, Donald, we need you to come out to lunch. And he said, oh, Frank, I can't, I'm working. And he said, no, you must come. And Donald said, well, there's the good Donald and the bad Donald. And Frank said, well, listen to the bad Donald. And he said, no, Frank, it's the good Donald that wants to go to lunch, not the bad Donald. But I propose tonight to seek out a 19th century kangaroo recipe, which I was reminded of when Adele wrote about spoke about the Edward Abbott book, which was called Slippery Joe, if I've got it right, which was flour, Slippery Bob. Flour, correct me here, flour, water, seasoning, emu fat and kangaroo's brains. And this was proposed as the...
joy.
I'm sure it was, yeah. Yeah, 19th century recipe. Finally, just want to thank you all for coming and forsaking at least part of your dinner time. Thank the Heritage Unit and the ACT Government putting together what looks like a really splendid festival, and more strength to them. To thank the museum and the representatives of the museum here, and mostly to thank Adele for a wonderful talk about food heritage, and we hope to have you back. Thanks, Adele.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.